Sup, freaks. It's your boy Marty Bent here to introduce you to this episode's sponsor. You freaks already know all about them, the Cash App. It's been the number one finance app in the App Store for the last 2 years, the first P2P payments app to allow you freaks to purchase Bitcoin. And they also have an incredible boost program. If you're not participating with your personalized boost card yet, what the hell are you waiting for? Go download the Cash App now with the boost card. You can go to merchants. Like Chick-fil-A, coffee shops, Whole Foods, Panera, Taco Bell, the list goes on. So many I can't even remember. You use your boost card there and you get a little discount because you're part of the boost program. It's like you're part of a special club. Just like you're part of the Stacking Sats club. And when you're done stacking sats on the Cash App, you can take that Bitcoin and send it to the personal wallet of your choice. When you take custody into your own hands and you take control of your financial sovereignty. Easily scan a QR code. Or copy-paste the address into the app and send it off to your Ledger, your Trezor, your Electrum, your cold storage, whatever it may be. So go find the Cash App in the Google Play Store or the App Store today and start stacking sats now. Hope you guys enjoy this episode with Jan and Pavel from Slush Pool. Very rare appearance by these two. Was happy to have them on and think you freaks are going to love it just as much as I did. Enjoy. What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy Marty Bent here on a Friday afternoon in a relegation studio we haven't used yet. This is the first time we're using this studio. I'm very excited. It's a little rainy out. We've got a very fun conversation in front of us. Blockchain Week has officially started in my mind. We've got a couple of seasoned veterans in from the Czech Republic, a couple members of the Slush Bowl team. I'd like to introduce you freaks to the co-CEOs, Jan Čapek and Pavel Morawiec. Did I get it right?
Yeah. Right. Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for coming by. How was your trip to America?
Pretty good. It was our pleasure coming.
Yeah. I'm very excited for this conversation. I was telling you earlier, we've never had any mining pool operators on or anybody like big in the mining industry on this podcast. So I'm very excited about this. Slush Pool in particular has a seasoned history. You guys are the oldest Bitcoin mining pool in existence. Slush Pool mined its first block in November of 2010 when you guys were still Bitcoin.cz mining, when Slush was around.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Well, we got involved sometime in 2013.
Yeah, before we get to that. Okay. We have a little background history here. Okay. So Slush Pool, for you freaks that don't know, out of all pools, has mined the third most Bitcoin of all time, over a million at this point. In my view, you guys are an altruistic, like very good actor in the space and a mining pool that has stood the test of time in an industry that is one of the most cutthroat industries in the world, not only in Bitcoin. I would argue with Bitcoin mining. Before we get into what you guys are doing at Slush Pool, like you were mentioning, Jan, you guys came into 2013. What were you doing before 2013? How'd you get into Bitcoin? What drove you guys to Bitcoin? And then Slush in particular?
Well, we sort of heard about Bitcoin by that time, around 2010 or 11. It was the first time. But we didn't think it was like that serious. So me and Pavel, we had a company doing embedded software for embedded devices. It's still called Brain Systems. And that's the company behind the pool right now. So we were doing programming for industry players that do gensets and stuff like that. So we are like the firmware guys. We know how to do embedded Linux and real-time stuff. So that's where we were making money on. But then when we had the opportunity to enter the Bitcoin field, it was 2013, we thought we shouldn't miss it the second time. So we got involved. Maybe Pavel has some more inputs on this.
I think you summarized it.
In clearly. Mining draw you guys in because of the hardware aspect, the firmware aspect?
Not really. Yeah. I think we realize that Bitcoin idea is great, which we didn't realize the first time. And I was the best friend of Marek Slush in childhood, and he was really into Bitcoin, and we talked more. And
so he was your Bitcoin friend that wore you down eventually?
Yeah, you can tell that probably. Yeah, but he was pretty, he started the pool himself, single person, and it was too much for him at that time, and he wanted to focus on the work around Trezor, so he wanted to create a company in the long run. So he proposed us to join the pool or be part of the pool. So right now we, and you know, it was 2013, and since then point we are fully committed to Bitcoin. We don't do anything else.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's evident. You guys have stuck around throughout the years. I'm showing you this chart. We'll get to that eventually, of pool distribution throughout time. You guys had a significant share at the beginning through like 2014, 2015. The share dropped a little bit. We were talking a little bit why before, and now it seems like you guys are making a resurgence. But before we jump into like the dynamics of the mining pool industry in particular, let's talk about the software that creates these mining pools. So you guys created Stratum in 2013, and that was an iteration or a replacement of Getwork, correct?
It's not an iteration, it's a complete rewrite.
Like, yeah, yes.
But the principle of the protocol is completely different. Because at the beginning, the original protocol was absolutely inefficient, and Stratum was an idea how to make it much more better designed or much more efficient for miners. Because the more connections you do, you need to create the protocol for the specific task. So Marek at the time tried to solve that with Stratum, and it's pretty old protocol. And today is obviously obsolete in a lot of sense. You would design it differently if you had all the information you have today. But it's good enough for, all the mining is done through Stratum today.
And let's talk about sort of the dynamics of how this pool works. Like, so as a pool operator, what is your function and what are you facilitating for these individual miners that are sending a hash rate towards your pool?
Well, our primary purpose is to aggregate the hashing power. So basically, it means that the miners, if they were mining on their own, their participation in the total network hash rate is very insignificant. But the minimum amount of Bitcoin that you can mine is one block, right? So this block finding process called mining is a statistical process that has some Poisson distribution. That's how the blocks arrive. Basically, any previous work has nothing to do with whatever you find in the future, so it's completely unrelated. It's like as if you were rolling a dice and thinking, like, what's the probability that I find a number smaller than 3 or whatever. So the point of the pool is to aggregate those people who are rolling the dice and making their variance smaller. So the probability is still the same, but their variance in the distribution of the reward is smaller, so that's the point of the pool.
Yes, so you get some rewards frequently,
yep.
So you can calculate some numbers. It's not a random thing. If you're a solo miner, you can get one block roughly, for example, once in a year, which is disaster if you try to run it as a business. But once you join a pool, you can get your rewards every single day. So this is the basic principle of why people do that.
So how does divvying up the rewards go on your end? Because that's actually something that came to the fore of the conversation this week that I haven't thought about in a while, is the fact when you guys mine a block, you don't have access to that, the block reward for 100 blocks because the Coinbase transaction doesn't get released. So how are you guys sort of taking that into consideration and divvying it out based off?
Yeah. That's right. We are basically calculating what amount of Bitcoins everybody deserves for the block. And if we see that the mined block is deep enough in the blockchain, we just add the rewards to the balance of the user.
What is deep enough?
100.
100.
Yeah, 100
confirmations from 96. 50 right now internally, but we advertise 100 because it's the number used by blockchain itself. But you always have the buffer. So we theoretically we could pay the rewards earlier, but there is still some security number you want to keep, because the rewards are technically possible and we don't want to be like paying coins and your reward. It would be a mess.
Right.
The thing is, I think the Bitcoin Core even refuses to, you cannot spend the block before it matures, and the constant number of the depth, how deep in the blockchain the block is, that's what's being checked by the Bitcoin Core. And there's some soft limit that you can tweak technically. You basically can hack your source and make the Bitcoin Core pay out the block earlier, a little bit earlier, but there are some constraints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we never pay exactly the coins.
It doesn't matter, right? Which coins you're technically paying out, because you have some stack from the previous blocks and so on. And users have different thresholds for payout. So
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
To be the most recent block in mind. You have reserves from other blocks. What did you guys think about the whole CZ coming out and saying that he thought about it anymore this week?
It's
it's a big story. It's a big story.
A big story.
I think Jimmy Song was right when he wrote, I think it was a Twitter post something, that it's a pity that they didn't try.
Right.
Because if they tried and failed, it would be so great. And everybody in the industry is 100% sure they would fail with the reorging.
So
it's missed opportunity. It's like with every other fork. You can fork Bitcoin anytime you want, but we all already know that it doesn't make Bitcoin less strong. It's
right.
Even stronger. So it's a missed opportunity from my point of view.
What did you think of the proposition by like Jeremy Rubin and a couple others to basically try to double spend Binance had access to those private keys? Obviously they did, and they tried to double spend that transaction with a fat fee, like a thousand Bitcoin fee to the top 10 mining pools that helped in this process as a mining pool. And you saw that, would that entice you at all?
Well, right, yeah, but they didn't do it, right? So, I mean, this is like the last resort that you could or you should do. It actually makes sense. I mean, if you know something like this happened and it happened in a big batch, you can do it. Why not? Mm-hmm. But the thing is, they didn't do it, right?
Yeah.
So from theoretical perspective, if you have security measures and processes defined that you can do it as like the last resort
Well, how would the security measures even work? They would have to know that somebody stole their coins, and then how would it work, like alerting you guys that, hey, we would like to reorg this as quick as possible? They would have to construct a transaction pretty quickly.
Yeah, I don't think it's about reorging, but you can detect that mempool contains the transaction which
mm-hmm.
steals your money. You can detect it pretty easily if you monitor what's happening on the network. And what you can do is to create your own transaction spending the same outputs and put there some crazy fee so that the miners would prefer your transaction before the other transaction. I'm not sure about the technical details of it. I'm pretty sure it's doable. And we even did a node. We are redesigning some money-related clearing subsystem right now, and we are probably doing this kind of research in this topic as well.
Yeah.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, well,
once you start to, yeah.
Well, this incident sort of high, and this is what we talked about in our weekly show yesterday, Rabbit Hole Recap. It sort of highlights the incompetence of some of the industry players, like the fact that CZ sort of thought this was even probable, especially 6 hours after the fact, at least.
Yeah, but nobody can know the details about everything.
Yeah.
And I pretty appreciate the fact that they were open about the thought process, and he came out and say, okay, it was a bad idea, and I know it now. So it's perfectly fine to have this conversation so people can be brought to the topic and understand more about how Bitcoin works. So at the end, I think it's a good thing.
It's actually very educating.
It was a great, we learned a lot this week. It was a great, like, relearning process.
It pretty much overshadowed everything else. Even the exchange rate, nobody talks about the exchange rate, but people talk about this reorg thing.
Well, how crazy is it that we had Tether, Binance, get 2 weeks ago, this last week, and the price just blew through. I think it's at like 6,400 right now. I don't have it up right now, but
I just read some update that there are some problems with withdrawals from Bitfinex as well.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. So, I think the exchange rate is like the form of the honey badger. It just doesn't matter.
That's a good thing. Like,
I like, let's dive into that. Why do you think it doesn't matter?
Oh, you mean the problems or the exchange rate? Why the
exchange rate? Yeah.
Well, the reason why we're into Bitcoin is I think this is the future of the money, and this is like the hard money that you have, and we're really interested in the technical aspects, and the exchange rate is a nice thing to have that creates the incentive to stay in the industry, but it doesn't have to be like super crazy.
It's great for running a company. Mm-hmm. But not necessarily the only thing. We have some internal number, which is we need to be in north of the number and be fine with running the company, and anything better is just a bonus.
Is are we allowed to talk about that specific number or
no? So surprising, I guess.
We can say it relates to the size of the company, so you can always change the size of the company. And
you're trying to move the number upward, hiring more people. But yeah, we are bound to the exchange rate, obviously. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the price rising is, I think, always.
It's always exciting, right?
Oh yeah.
Even in all this hoopla this week, it's been fun. I found myself up like watching the charts last night for the first time in a while. So it was approaching like 6,200. I was like, oh man,
again. I personally, I uninstalled all the widgets showing me the price because it's a distraction basically. And we went through times when the price was dropping and still you have to do your work. So
well, let's talk about that. Let's jump into the history of Slushpool. Let's talk about this chart. So you guys came out with a pretty hot start. You got a nice considerable chunk of the hash rate. Today you're sitting about 4.7 exahash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, what
it's like 10% of the...
What are we at overall? Well, like 62 that. Overall?
Or yeah, I didn't check lately. Yeah, we really did. We can do the calculation.
It's the conflict of everyday stuff you do. Mm-hmm. And once in a while, you can look at...
You can recheck and...
You're somewhere between 5 and 10% right now.
Yeah.
Overall network.
Probably closer to 10. Mm-hmm. But yeah, roughly in these nice numbers.
And so, like you were saying, your bear markets happened before 2014, 2015, probably being one, and your hash rate share diminished in that period. What was going on back then?
It was, I think it was a combination of a few factors. The first one, when we got into the industry, there was, the pool itself was like a prototype, right? And it was suffering from scaling issues and all these things. So we were like really building the infrastructure from one server to being like worldwide spread all over the world. So paying for this technological debt took some time. Second factor, 2013-14 was the time when ASICs were coming. So all the GPU guys and the ones, the geeks who were mining in their dormitory rooms and wherever, were just going out of the game because their mining rigs were just obsolete. So they went for altcoins, whatever.
You say shitcoins.
Yeah.
You can let loose here. Don't worry. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So these guys were sort of like leaving us. And initially the ASICs were pretty much in the hands of the manufacturers. So, and those had no incentive to connect to some, pool, which would not bring them anything if they have enough hash rate so that they can run their own, right, mining operation.
Don't worry about variance if they're at that.
Yeah, yeah. So these three factors, and including the exchange rate sort of like going down, that all turned into this trend of our market share going up to like 3% or something like that.
Yeah,
it was like the critical boundary. If the pool starts hitting like 3%, then the variance starts stepping in because then you're mining like you should be mining like 3-4 blocks a day, I think. What is it, 50th out of 144?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
But I'd say it's somewhere between two and three blocks. Mm-hmm. And that means you can also mine zero. And you have this psychological effect. Like, statistically, it works. You would be mining these number of blocks, and on average, you would get to the number. But when a miner sees that you mine zero blocks during 24 hours, and because we as a humans are, you know, are like day-oriented, right? We sleep, we wake up, we check mm-hmm. status of certain things, like, how is my business doing? How is my miners doing? They got, you know, excited, sort of, like, if there is something wrong with the pool. Because if it's mining zero blocks, it means the lock is low, or you could have some technical problem. So it started this spiral of people, you know, disconnecting from the pool and making things even worse. So we got through this.
You survived a mining death spiral?
Yeah. We really survived this. And then things started changing with the exchange rate, with the technological updates that we made in the pool. And then it started rising. And I think that was when the hash rate started rising again. It was at the time when the big farms, especially in the Western world, because majority of our users are from the Western world, like US and so on, they needed some trusted entity that they could direct their hash rate to. And they apparently chose us for some reason. So that's the time where our market share started like going up a little bit and being really stable.
Well, I think I know the reason. I think it's because you guys have been very good actors in the space for a consistent amount of time, and I think you guys have developed a brand, at least in the first decade, that suits you well in again, a cutthroat industry. Do you sympathize with that? Do you guys feel that way about yourselves, that you're sort of good to the community, community's good back to you in that aspect?
But what we say, we try to be the good guys.
Yeah.
Like, don't do anything that's not like morally sustainable or mm-hmm. acceptable.
And there is a lot of actors in the space behaving this way, and it's an honor to be in the space. And we think it's a great, great feeling to be part of the whole movement, let's say. And it would be really short-sighted to like prioritize momentary monetary effect. So yeah, we feel pretty comfortable in this position. And Marek started with this approach really, really back in the old days.
So yeah,
it's a great thing.
Yeah, thank you for holding strong and being so principled in an industry that has a lot of unprincipled people in it, outside of Bitcoin, I would say.
It's easier than you think, because you don't have to think about the shady space.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty easy. You can focus on technology or your internal problems. We had a lot of technical debt, and we still have some. So you can focus on the work and what's good for the customers, and don't think about a lot of other stuff.
I think being a bad actor is very exhausting, because you have to keep some integrity in what you're saying and doing. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's going to break down. And if you try to think always in the honest way, it's easier to stay consistent, because you can always check, like, is this good? And yes, I'll do it.
yeah, this saying one.
It's like difficult to be lying.
Right? I'm not a good liar at all.
Yeah, but he and me, we both have memory like hamster. So yeah. You need to keep your lie and repeat it in the future. And it's mm-hmm. really difficult. And we can remember a lot of things, so it's easier to tell the truth and just
I'm not trying to blow smoke up my own ass here, but like, I'm a bad liar too. Like, when I do lie, I'm like, damn it, I just lied, like, what the hell, I feel like I should tell my lie. But no, it's crazy. And again, I think that is why people are drawn towards Slushpool, and you guys are between close to 10% of network hash rate right now. You're talking about focusing on technology. What have you guys been focusing on most recently? What's on the roadmap at Slushpool?
Well, let's cover the Brains OS adventure and ASIC boost, maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
So it all started a year ago when there were new miners from Minasilicon called T1s. Well, they were called Dragon Mints, whatever.
Dragon Mints,
yeah. And we were involved in testing them, and helping with a proposal for, actually we were the authors of the proposal to use some version bits and Stratum extension that would allow using them or configuring them so that mining devices that support ASIC boost could operate, could be used for mining. And these devices, I mean, the Dragonman's T1s, they could not work without ASIC boost. They had an optimization that just takes this functionality out of the chip, so you really have to run it with ASIC boost, otherwise you just are not efficient. So we were involved with this, and at that time we were kind of thinking that there would be some business deal between us and Silicon that would allow us to, you know, also participate in firmware development. But the deal never happened, so we had like a bunch of work that we already did on mining firmware that we didn't know what we were going to do about. And then we started thinking, okay, hold on. So we had this thing. We want to make it open source, but what is the most popular miner in the market right now? And that was the S9s. And since we were into the ASIC boost adventure already, we were like, well, people say that this device apparently supports ASIC boost, but it doesn't work. So we started researching this topic, and it turned out that the devices really can do ASIC boost. So once you turn it on, you're saving right away 13% of energy. But the problem was that the manufacturer somehow made the part of the miner, which is like a small firmware in the FPGA, with a small bug. And this bug means it was...
like a chip.
The bug in the firmware was that it was touching the wrong bits in the version field of the Bitcoin block header. Mm-hmm. And these were like critically wrong in a way that this was invalid work from the Bitcoin network perspective. So any block that you would find would not be accepted because the version bits were like wrong. So we were thinking, okay, let's fix it. And it turned out that it's not easy to fix it because this FPGA code is not like regular code for, you know, when you write your software and you compile it. And it's not worth reverse engineering because it's really difficult. It's basically a code for describing hardware, gates and so on. So we started writing our own part, but also at that time, I think we published the story about our findings and saying basically we will continue on this initiative or we will make the manufacturer publish at least a fix to this. It took like a week or two and then they released the firmware that was supporting ASIC boost. And it was already at the time when we came up with the idea of the Brains OS. It was, I think, the second release that already had this ASIC boost support with this FPGA code fixed from Bitmain. But nevertheless, we still think that this is not an open source variant because there's some small part that's still coming from the manufacturer. So we still keep on working on the open source alternative that would be integrated into Brains OS. So this was like sort of like a hobby project, but we still see it as an extension, logical extension to what we have in the pool because we're providing the mining service and it's easier to integrate with a farm that's running our firmware, you know, that we know works correctly with the Stratum protocol. Because that was like the second motivation for the project, that there were like historically many problems with the firmwares where they would be. You would even see them today where somebody releases new mining hardware, it has problems like mining with certain pools because they have some bugs in the firmware. So it's easier to take care of the whole software stack, but at the same time keeping it open source so that people can audit it and can, if they want, they can build their own images and make sure that they're really running what they can trust.
Mm-hmm. Now it's crazy how like the interaction between the firmware and the hardware can sort of affect your hash rate and the performance of your miner. And so I guess if you can explain like a couple of things at the firmware level that would affect a miner's performance and what you're looking at. Like you were just talking about the version bits, you fixed that, but what else, like fan cooling, stuff like that, tempering the fans and other sort of operations at the firmware level?
Yeah, I don't think that there is a lot of space what you can do in the firmware for making the device more efficient. Mm-hmm. It's about tweaking the parameters for a particular environment, like if you have strong fans in your operation, you don't have to run the fans on the miner as fast. But these are small things. The firmware thing is more about like reliability to connect to every pool and managing the devices securely and knowing what you actually run on the devices, because there are some problems with hijacking the firmware or mm-hmm. the miners through some call home problems. So it's more about security than efficiency, and the ASIC boost is, in my opinion, something special in this sense.
Yeah, so that's ASIC boost is a storied history in Bitcoin. Bitmain famously doing covert ASIC boost, where they were taking advantage of this before most people really knew about it.
There are rumors they did it. I don't think anybody can prove it easily, and it doesn't matter.
No,
because the overt ASIC boost is more efficient. Mm-hmm. So once it was the basic motivation for us to help this kind of ASIC boost to be used all over the world, because it makes mining more efficient and it like disables the overt ASIC boost because it's less efficient. So once everybody can use the version rolling, there is all the incentives are aligned. There is no need for overt ASIC boost, so that miners don't bother with what's inside the code base.
There's incentives perking them their heads in the system again.
Yeah.
So the incentives drive everything in Bitcoin, which is beautiful. And the incentive to overtly use ASIC boost is there now. But it was interesting that during that whole Ampleed was a different thing. That's when they could remotely shut down.
It was the calling home thing.
Were you guys affected by that at all? Were miners in your pool?
Not really. I think we had a couple cases where somebody was reporting hijacking of the hash rate, but it was the BGP thing mm-hmm. where you can really make the farm thinking it's connected to the pool, it's connected somewhere else, even though the IP addresses are correct.
Yeah, but it's not really frequent.
It's not very frequent.
All years, it's not really frequent, but it's still.
But the new protocol should really take care of this. But like one thing that I still find very interesting about the ASIC boost is that, specifically with the S9s, is that nobody ever, people were complaining, but this is not about complaining. This is more for a lawsuit, because it's like, if you buy some product and I would just tell you that it just doesn't have this feature and it would have the feature hidden and it would be the manufacturer who would decide for you that you cannot use it, and it would affect directly your cost of operation, because it's not, ASIC boost will not give you like, it will not give you extra like hashing power, but it causes that you save energy. Mm-hmm. So you can cut your electricity cost by 13% if you use, I would be that technical, if you use 4 mid states, that's the setting for the hashing chips. If you do like only 2 mid states, which is like the first phase of the SHA function that's running in the chips, you do like 8%. So you can save between 8 and 13%. And you could have been using that feature since day one when the S9s came out. So I'm really, I don't know, this is interesting for me.
All right. Bitmain's a very interesting story.
Oh yeah.
I've referred to them as the Icarus of the early Bitcoin days. Flew too close to the sun, thought they were too hot for their own shit, and are falling to earth right now.
Yeah, it's a good analogy, I think. So it surprises me so much.
Why is
this? They were in such a great position. Like they dominated the market. And if you fast forward 2 years, the scene is completely different than it used to be. So I don't know. It surprises me very much.
Bitcoin Network's a ruthless bitch. If you try to wrong her, she will smite you. It's they learned a hard lesson, right? And so, as company that's entrenched in the mining industry. What have you guys noticed any fallout from Bitmain's fall from grace? Any particular companies stepping in where they're sort of falling short? Are you seeing the market sort of rout around them?
Thinking.
Or do you think it just doesn't matter as we get closer to ASIC commodification?
Yeah, that's a big topic.
Yeah, it is. We would love to see as many manufacturers as possible. It would be great for the whole ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
So in this sense, I'm pretty okay what happened to Bitmain. Not necessarily because I would wish them anything bad, but it was too much. Their dominance was too strong.
Mm-hmm.
And it was felt in the community. So this is changing in a good direction.
The latest actions from Bitmain are also very interesting. Where like one day somebody on our Telegram chat, or it was also, I think he also even tweeted about it. He said, "Oh hey, I just upgraded my S9," and he was running the factory firmware, not BrainOS, with the March update, whatever. And then suddenly he couldn't log in through SSH to his miner anymore, and the firmware image is now digitally signed. So that means, like, until then you could technically feed the miner with any image that would be valid, and the miner would just, you know, be dumb, and it would just flash like anything that you give it. If it was to brick it, it would become brick. But this was the standard mechanism that we were using to upgrade from the factory firmware to BrainOS. But now they added a feature that actually checks the digital signature of the image that you're feeding it. And obviously, like, we don't have their private keys, right? So we cannot anymore take our BrainOS image, feed it to the S9 that has been upgraded, is going to refuse it. Which is a good thing, in a way that your device should not accept like any firmware image. It should check the signatures. This is what we do with the BrainOS as well, because if you do upgrade, we check the signatures, because the standard Linux distribution, like anything. This is a good thing. But you as a user, if you really want to, you should have a way to do what you want. That means like flashing it with anything that you like.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand the incentive why they're doing it, because it's really pissing off the users. I mean, it's like even your car manufacturer would just say you cannot drive anymore your car because you think you're not competent to do it.
Yeah,
we'll have somebody else drive it for you.
Do you think they're spinning up a pool of their own? Well, they already have.
They already have.
They already have. Yeah,
I think they're.
Their own.
Yeah, I don't know what's behind
it. It's not about pools. We don't have any special position with BrainOS in regards of the pool. There is no like mining at our pool when you plug in the device or start the firmware.
Mm-hmm.
You can obviously point it to our pool and it will work, but you can use the device for mining at any pool you decide. So the whole firmware thing is not about pool, I think.
No. What is Bitmain doing? So Jihan's out. His other co-founder's out, right? There's somebody new in Marcon or something like that. I forget.
We don't have any.
Yeah, we don't have all the insights. Yeah. But
to be honest,
I thought you guys were coming with all the good
really
information.
Much about the politics and what they do at the highest level. It's difficult to get information, and we don't try to get any special.
We have met with some Bitmain representatives in Chile. It was the La Bitconf, which is a conference in there. And they were very... I was actually in a panel with them, and they were very positive. And they were saying, oh, we are going to be the good guys now, and we're going to be open sourcing everything, and very transparent and stuff like that. And whoops, they released the S15, and we keep asking them, like, when are you going to release the sources so that we can integrate it into our firmware? It never happened. So, I mean, I really don't know.
Well, if recent history shows, they're probably embarrassed by the performance to release it, because they've had bad wafer deliveries recently, haven't they? Or bad wafer designs?
I think the S15s were a big failure because they used the 7-nanometer technology, but it's like super expensive. So I think they it's not profitable for them to sell them.
Yeah, the problem was a bad yield. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough thing to create so small chips. So.
So we mentioned ASIC commodification earlier.
Yeah.
How far along that path are we? How close to like a pure commodified ASIC market are we?
It's kind of a heated topic.
Why is this?
Right now, the problem is that the manufacturers, they don't have a good incentive. And it's obvious. They have no incentive to sell the ASIC chips.
Are we talking about the foundries or?
They want to make profit, and they can make profit in two ways. If they're selling the chips, then their margin has to be on the chips, and it has to be pretty big. Or they can create an added value and, you know, pack the chips into mining devices where they can make additional margin. So economically, this makes sense. But if you try to ask them, can we have the chips? Yes, you can have them. But the problem is that you're taking the risk, which could be absorbed by a futures market, maybe. You would be taking the risk of the chips not being performing well or not being on time, available, and so on. This can be overcome. But the problem is the initial price that's already usually too high for anybody to actually make anything out of these chips, like produce physical hardware, because you would always be above the cost of the manufacturer. So we had one day the idea of creating something called ASIC Foundation that would be like a nonprofit organization taking care of running these manufacturing batches of chips. And basically, on a long run, forcing the other manufacturers also joining the foundation and selling the chips through the foundation.
It was meant as a non-profit organization who would organize the trading with the chips so that everybody can buy it.
Because the big thing is you have to rent the space on the foundry floors to the manufacturers.
You guys were just
rent out like a huge chunk of time on the floor, and the manufacturers come in one at a time, and
But then you can create some publicly known rules how you can participate in buying the chips. There can be an open trade with the chips. So if anybody can create better miner, you could buy or sell the chips. The futures it was meant as a futures market for the chips, which are in production, being delivered in the future.
And being useful.
There is a lot of interesting things what you could do that. But the biggest problem is you need to control somehow the manufacturing part of the chips. And we almost did an agreement with some manufacturer, but then it collapsed because, obviously.
It was at the time when the exchange rate went really crazy. And this exactly demonstrated the case where even though we were sort of very close to the deal, it was at the time, I think, 6,000 was the exchange rate, and then it was doing this, and the manufacturers started sort of like withdrawing from all the deals because they saw they could make much more money just by running their own business and selling the full product. So it was, for us, a proof that it is not possible to do any kind of activity like this with a commercial subject, with a commercial entity or business partner. It just has to be done by the foundation itself, outsourcing the manufacturing process, obviously, to the foundries, but it would be the entity taking care of this.
Yeah. How hard would it be to get a fifth foundry out there for Bitcoiners only?
Well, I think Adam back one day tweeted the exchange rate is not quite there yet, but some, I don't know, it was TSMC or GlobalFoundries, they were selling some manufacturing plant. So when the exchange rate is there, it could be that the Bitcoin community could actually buy a plant like this. Maybe it's too naive, but
maybe this would crowdsourcing
project, buying a foundry and running this. It would be awesome project.
All right, freaks, you heard it here first on Tales from the Crypt. We're starting the crowdsourcing project for a foundry. We're gonna make it happen. We need to get the
ASIC commodification. Just a few billion dollars.
The pineapple fund. I think the pineapple fund will be able to cover this in a few years. So hey, anybody riding the pineapple fund out there, you ain't on, just keep this in mind. So what else are you guys looking forward to? I mean, we talk about mining specifically, like you guys, again, like you think Bitcoin is the future money of the world. Why is this? What in your life has led you to come to this conclusion? Any personal experiences growing up,
Well, for me, the most fascinating thing is that you finally have your money under your control, which doesn't happen with regular money anymore, and you have something that's immutable, right? There's not too many things that are digital in our lives that are immutable. This is written once and you cannot change it. And these are like two fascinating technical things that both came together in the form of Bitcoin. And I can't imagine as an IT guy that I would be active in any other industry just because of these two reasons. Yeah, I mean, you can write software for anything, but this is the era where...
It's a great mixture of awesome technology and the connection with freedom and personal responsibility at the same time. I think Bitcoin can make larger point in the sense that people should take their responsibility for their lives themselves, and Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, in a sense,
demand that.
Can give you the lesson, because you need to secure your keys, you need to start about things, how and why you do what you do. You can mess up, you can lose some coins. So it's a broader message Bitcoin can bring.
You know, it's been said on this podcast a lot, Bitcoin demands extreme ownership. And I mean, we see, like, we were talking about Binance earlier and these exchange hacks. Like, that's, I think, that's a cause for a lot of FUD in the mainstream headlines. People see these exchange hacks, they extrapolate it to Bitcoin, say Bitcoin's been hacked. And it's like, no, this is a
service related to it that got hacked.
But a lot of people have like the preconceived notions of how they interact with the traditional banking system and financial system, and they just assume, oh, this is the way Bitcoin will work. But it's like, no, this is, again, it's a digital, it's a bearer asset too. So like, you have to take it into your control and control your keys. And where do you think we are in terms of sort of educating the masses about this process? This is definitely going to be a learning experience, and that's something we talk about a lot here too. Like, it's something that I'm worried about in the long run. It's like apathy, people not wanting to take this control. Do you see a path through which people come around and your average Joe starts taking control of his private keys?
Well, I think I think we still have the problem that the average Joe doesn't even know there are some private keys. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a long process. And I think it has to start in elementary school, where people really have to start understanding cryptography, not on a mathematical level, but to understand that this is the tool that the humanity is going to use. And it's like a regular day thing.
It's getting better. The more people understand the principles, the more people can get it from them. It's a long process, obviously. And I don't think everybody must have their keys and all the coins, controlling the coins in this sense, but understanding the principles are key, and it's spreading. It's gonna take a lot of time, obviously, but I think there is a lot of knowledgeable people already, and the more Bitcoin is in headlines and more people are describing all these principles, the easier it is to just get used to it. And once you really face it yourself, you already know that there are some principles behind it. You can dig deeper, ask people around. So I'm pretty optimistic. I don't have any like years when it's gonna be like known by everybody, but I'm pretty optimistic about it. Going in a good direction.
Yeah, it's like when the world first got industrial plumbing and everybody had to learn how to wash their hands, wipe their ass, and take a shower.
Pretty close.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's the greatest analogy, but maybe.
No, you have to learn how to wash your hands on the internet and take care of your private keys.
Control. Yeah. Never thought about it in from this direction.
That was first posited by Santiago Siri on this podcast a couple years ago. But it does make sense, yeah. It's like a learning, like you said, like ideally kids will start learning this in school, and that's another thing. Like, so we were born in this inflection point, people our age and older, where we're sort of like the bridge between the world before the internet was mainstream and the world that the internet is now mainstream in. And I had my nephew's birthday party as a young kid last night. I'm looking at him and the way he's interacting with stuff. I'm like, there's no way Bitcoin isn't a thing.
Yeah, it's about exposure to the core concepts. And there needs to be some critical mass of people understanding the concepts and talking about it. But for the newcomers, for especially the younger people, the concepts would be ever present, like normal thing. They didn't have to understand the technical details, but it's much easier for them to get it because it's nothing completely different than they are used to, because they are hearing about the concepts already.
Yeah.
I think one more era that's slightly changing already is the privacy concerns. You know, we had a few years ago, we had people saying like, oh, I don't care where I, you know, put my photos, and I use these surveys, and it, you know, and now people do realize that those services that are for free are not that free as they look like, because they sort of, you know, track what you're doing and they try to sell you things that you may not really need. But and I think this is already changing in the population, where people do realize that their privacy is the concern. And once you start caring about your privacy, it's very close to what you're getting with cryptocurrencies, specifically with Bitcoin or others. Bitcoin has some obviously some privacy issues, but it actually makes you think about those issues. So, yeah, I think it's getting a little better.
It's getting a little better, but, excuse me, we're at like a crossroads, right? We can either go full-fledged train down the tracks towards a China-like future, dystopian future, or we can go towards a future where people take extreme ownership of their data. And it's like an open battle for dystopia versus sovereignty, right?
Well, I definitely want to go for the second one.
Yeah, well, obviously that's why we're all here, right? Are you worried about like traditional state control, like having too much of a head start?
Yeah, it's actually happening. I mean, you'd see, we're in Europe, and we see this tracking also from the governments already. They want to know like everything that you do. One interesting thing. Yesterday, when we were flying from Prague to New York, we were flying Delta, and at the check-in desk in Prague on the airport, we would scan our passports. It would know the name of our hotel.
Yeah.
So where does the booking.com submit the data?
So they probably have in their terms and conditions, like, hey,
oh, yeah,
you're sending this right to Homeland Security.
Probably. Yeah.
It's not saying they did something against the conditions.
It's like,
it was
thing.
Just surprising. Like,
yeah, it's like,
and,
hey.
And then we had to ask like 30 questions by some guys from Delta, because we are going to enter US, and similar questions by the gate. And we were like, okay. I tried to troll the guys a bit.
Are you guys at a fintech concert or conference right now?
There are a lot of fintech conference.
No, I know, but when you're talking to, when I travel,
no,
like
I told him a Bitcoin conference.
Yeah. Bitcoin. I always say fintech.
Oh, he was like trying to really unveil the thing in layers. It was like the Onion method, right? Mm-hmm. So he would be like, why are you coming to the States? And I was like, well, I'm coming to a conference. Which conference is it? Well, it's an IT conference. What kind of IT conference is it? I was like, well, it's called MCC and it's a Bitcoin conference. Okay, so you're into Bitcoin. I was like, yes, I'm into Bitcoin. And then he would try to find out if I'm like consistent. And he would be like, so how is the Bitcoin doing now? And I was like, you mean the exchange rate? It's like, well, yeah. I was like, well, it's like 6,000. And he would be like, so it's been going up? No. I was like, well, yeah, but it was like 20K last year. So, you know, like he was really trying to find if anything I'm saying is consistent. But what was like funny for me internally is that we got really discussing about the Bitcoin stuff at a security infra.
Yeah. I have a story when I was crossing a border from Canada to US to visit some mining corporation. And I have met a policeman or some guard, and he was really pissed about Bitcoin because he thought he missed the opportunity.
I thought you were going to say he's on Quadriga X.
Yeah, so he asked me so many questions, and I tried to make the case for Bitcoin and try to pour some positivity on him so that he can let me in.
Don't worry, man, you didn't miss it.
It was a great conversation, but I didn't expect to have it at the borders.
Right. Well, it's crazy. At the borders and the airports, I've said this before, like, airports are like the testing grounds for dystopian, like, Orwellian features. Here in the States, since 9/11, it's gotten particularly bad, like, around, like, going through security. Sniffing dogs all over the place. You have to go through that scanner now. And it came out a couple weeks ago that some woman was flying JetBlue and she had a boarding pass on her and she thought she was going to have to hand that in and she didn't. They'd like literally use facial recognition to check her into her flight without her permission. And so like that is like another step forward in the airport sort of Orwellian dystopia is like stepping in. It's like people for some reason while going through airports just have no problem giving up their privacy and their freedom. You're like, oh yeah, we'll just listen to you.
It's so difficult to get to the another continent in 10 hours and right. Not crossing any airport.
Yeah.
So
did you guys fly into JFK?
Yeah.
How was customs there? Particularly bad.
It was a great experience.
I hate it so much coming back in. Like I came in from Riga last year and it was after like a 12-hour flight, 16-hour travel day. It was the most miserable experience of my life. You have to wait like 45 minutes in a line with a bunch of pissed off people.
Yeah, and the shape of the line is... I didn't see anything like that in any other place.
I'm going to say sorry for the people who work at the airport. They're never nice. They're always rude. I'm sure they yelled at you or to move along and stuff like that.
Yeah, too much people.
We're almost an hour in here. How much time do you guys have? You guys in a rush to get anywhere?
No, we're okay.
Okay. What's it like being having mined over 1 million Bitcoin as a pool? What's that? Do you guys feel responsibility, like being the arbiter of divvying out the rewards and stuff like that?
We never thought about the feeling because I mean that's being divided to the miners and I don't know. And
nice marketing number, obviously. Mm-hmm. But we tend to not keep the coins longer than it's necessary. So we want to send them to the miners as fast as possible because of security reasons, obviously. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, we're not a bank, so we're not really
holding.
Yeah.
Well, it's crazy. Like the number one miner or pool to mine the most Bitcoin, BTC Guild, they're not even around anymore, are they?
I think they got...
get bankrupt.
They went bankrupt, but
yeah.
I think
yeah.
Have they mined?
I'm not sure. It's long years ago.
Have they won 1.5 million Bitcoin?
Yeah, it was at the beginning, and it was the largest pool at the time. I think. I hope I remember correctly, but I think they used some kind of different payout scheme, and they had a bug, and they just paid too much something like that. I hope I'm not mistaken. I think it was roughly this.
No, but it's
just crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, it's crazy to see the churn in the mining pool industry in particular. So how do you guys survive that churn? You're saying to stay focused and build, but what else? Are you constantly looking over your shoulder at competitors? mining pools entering the market?
We don't look at the competition too much. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to make something really special, and focusing on your stuff is better in general, I think. And the competitors are arriving and then they're stopping to mine. We don't know why. It's pretty funny.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, that's one thing. That's actually a principle I have here, like the podcast and the newsletter I write is I watched Dr. Dre, Jimmy Iovine documentary series on HBO from like last year. There's one, a part where Jimmy Iovine in particular says, like, when you're working on something, just you gotta have like blinders on like a racing horse. Just like, don't look to your side. Just keep focused. And it seems like you guys are a perfect embodiment of keeping focus on your core competencies and just basically building better software for Bitcoiners to run, which is awesome.
Yeah, at the end, it's a service. So the service needs to be stable. Mm-hmm. People expect it runs all the time. And so
from this perspective, it's very similar to running a banking software. It has to be on 24/7, even though like banks or internet banking are sometimes down. This can be.
What's that like? You guys up at all hours? Do you guys have like...
We have duties spread across a team. And it just means like most of us are pretty much like 24/7 online, just in case something happens.
Yeah, when I can take my cell phone and put it outside of my reach, it's completely a lion feeling. Yeah. I'm not used to not having my cell phone all the time by myself for the last 6 years. So it's a really strange feeling to not have my cell phone by myself. Because all the time something can happen, and we have pretty strict like rules who can access the production servers. Mm-hmm. Really strict, because there's a lot of money flowing, and you cannot reverse Bitcoin transaction, as we all know. So there is only a couple of people who can like connect to the core pool infrastructure. So we need to be always ready to do what's necessary to run the operation.
Do you guys ever get to go on vacation or not?
Yeah, but it doesn't mean you don't have to be responsible on
vacation.
Yeah.
Depends how you define the vacation. If it's a place with 3G, 4G service, or you can be online within minutes, then you can go anywhere. So, like, I personally like sailing. So for me, I cannot go sailing too much off the coast.
Yeah,
but within 20 miles,
how many hours you have for reaching good internet connection? And the most critical points are when we fly together. Blew up everything. So we always buy a Wi-Fi.
You guys have separate flights on the way home after.
Yeah, sometimes we do.
I can't imagine like the stress of having to be up and available 24/7.
You get used to it.
Yeah.
And then not being available is the strange part.
I think this is the stressful part. If you know that you're not available, that's the problem. Because that's where...
I could have helped something, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. I love what you guys have built. Let's talk about BetterHash. BetterHash is something that I've been championing. I've been championing BetterHash. Not championing, but trying to make more people aware of it, because Matt Corallo has been on this podcast before. He's explained it. He seems to think that BetterHash would help decentralize Bitcoin more. You freaks who have listened to this podcast and have heard me describe BetterHash have probably understand it already, but I'll do it again. BetterHash simply takes what you guys do now in Stratum is construct a block template and divvy out the reward. BetterHash would allow individual miners within the pool to construct their own block templates, and you guys would simply divvy out the reward. You seem to think that it's not as great as advertised, and there may be a middle ground to be reached. So let's jump into that.
One thing to say is that we're in close contact with Matt Corallo, and we've been discussing all the details about BetterHash and what could be done differently so that this could be like the next industry standard. Like for us, the current proposal doesn't fulfill some criteria, specifically on latency, some performance that you would expect for such a big protocol change. At the same time, the ideas of ensuring security and allowing this work selection process on the miner side possible, that's obviously a very good idea, and that's something that we would like to integrate as well. So the current status is that we have some counter proposal that's already like formally written, and we are really working together with Matt to come up with the best solution for the industry that would be like a quality changer. It's simply just too many devices, and you cannot just roll out some prototype. It has to be really well thought. So I think it's very useful to take the time for the development and like really make the right decisions. And we still have the time ahead of us where this would be like, you know, openly discussed, and we'll see what comes out of it.
Yeah, because you guys have a lot of sunk cost to the software that you're building now, and what would that mean to like try to take on an endeavor like implementing a better hash or something similar to it? Like, what would you guys like, drop everything work on that? Or
yeah, we would love to do that.
Yeah.
But from the experience with Stratum for the last years, there is a lot of different use cases you need to cover. So it needs to be right. It's super difficult to change it in the future, and there were some tweaks of the version 1 of Stratum, and it makes a large confusion. So every firmware can have slightly different dialects of the protocol. So it takes time. Better hash in general is a great idea in principle, because it brings a new possibility to miners to allow better distribution of work selection, let's say, or choosing which transaction should be put into block. So this idea is great. But there is a lot of technical stuff which needs to be done perfectly, or we think it can be done better than in better hash. And one particular problem we had with the proposal was it created too much risk on the pool side, in the sense that if the miners with their firmware or software are misbehaving, either probably because of a bug, we would not be able to double check it. So we would blindly need to just accept the data from the miners through the protocol. And we try to find a way how to make it no brainer for pools to like bring the new protocol in life. So there needs to be zero risk for them. It needs to be more efficient, more secure, and there needs to be some good outcomes even for pools to implement, because it's obviously work.
Yeah, so there are like obvious like pain points within BetterHash that you think you could tweak and make better, or do you think it's...
Yeah, we already had a proposal before. We understand there is BetterHash, but we didn't incorporate the work selection before, so we tried to merge the two principles or point of views to one protocol, and I think we are pretty close to nailing it. But there are still some discussions with Matt, because obviously we would like to be as good as possible for everybody, so that there is a high chance that it's going to be supported by as many people in the world as possible, because it's the only thing how it can substitute the protocol the first protocol.
Yeah, he seems to think that Bitcoin's potential decentralization would be severely reduced if a protocol like this isn't implemented. Are you under the same volition?
I don't think so. It's a great thing you have, so that you as a miner has the chance to use the feature. Still, I think most of the miners would be profit-driven, so they would like to mine as valuable block as possible by the fee amount. So all the pools, or majority of pools, choose the blocks by fee amount.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start to make different block, you need to make the block less valuable.
So you could have individual miners running a better hash protocol, sort of bring down the potential fees for everybody else in the pool.
Yes,
and it's one of the problems. Yeah, you need to calculate this properly on the pool side, so that if somebody wants to mine 300k blocks and not one megabyte blocks, he can, but obviously there are not going to be as many transactions in the block as a normal block, so the miner needs to be paid less, because other miners who would like to mine normal blocks needs to get the reward they expect. So there is a lot of maths involved, so I don't think it's going to be ever like really must used feature, but it's great to have it. So if somebody wants to have the control, it has the possibility.
Sort of like a security measure that you don't want to use, but you can, you have an option to use it, and that sort of prevents the attackers.
Yes,
and right. Somebody decides for the censorship. If the current mining protocol was like really massively used by the pools for censorship, if the mining pools would collude, then this would allow the miners
to toggle it on.
Right.
Yes. That makes sense.
That's not as the pool is deciding, right? The transactions.
Yeah, that's something we talk about too, the Bitcoin Core trying to make that more modular, and you can even make this pool software more modular as well, it seems.
Right.
That seems like a great middle ground, in my opinion. You don't want it's the first time I've like thinking through this, individual miners with the fees, not getting the most fees out of it.
The corner case is, what if I as a miner decide to mine empty blocks? I have some special preference. I just want all blocks to be all blocks that I make to be empty. So that means like that's zero fees for the other miners that also have the share on this block.
Yeah, they're expending energy.
Right, right. Yeah. So this has to be properly calculated so that it's transparent and then fair for everybody.
Yeah.
And that's the difficult part. The technical part about the negotiation, how to do it properly, that's the easier one.
Yeah, it's actually making it happen. Because like we were talking about earlier, like you have some miners who can't even run their own full nodes, and it would be hard for them.
That was the reason why we really want to be able to double check the work. Because firmware or software in general have a lot of bugs in it, and we can like fix the bugs really efficiently, and we are responsible if our service doesn't work as it should be working, so we have the greatest incentive to do it right, but we cannot say everybody else is gonna do a good job. And other miners would pay for mistakes of different miners if we cannot prevent the error. So there are these kind of problems we need to solve in the protocol, and it's a lot of other small nuances which just need to be right, and I think it's pretty close to be finished, but
no, it's these small externalities that rear their heads out of nowhere, it seems. It's crazy. And again, it goes back to incentives as well. You guys have brand recognition that's almost 10 years old at this point, so you have a very high incentive to protect that and provide the highest quality service that you can.
Nobody wants to do shitty work. But, yeah. And we need to deal with the firmware or the protocol every single day.
That was actually a good pun, though. Nobody wants to do shitty work. You don't want individual miners doing shitty work in your pool.
Basically, anything that you do should be in line with solving some problem that you have, right? I mean, when Linus made the Linux kernel, he had a problem that he didn't have free open source Unix distribution or Unix system. And this is very similar to, like, we were facing with various firmware issues, so we came up with the idea, okay, we know how to make the mining protocol, we can have the firmware, if the firmware is open source and becomes sort of like industry standard for this era, it would be very easy to roll out for the community any changes in the protocol, because it could be tested, it would be like single source, audited by the community. So that's the idea behind all this that we're doing. We try to come up with some compact solution to all these topics. Sort of like Bitcoin Core is audited in open source, but nobody really cares about the mining firmwares, which are actually, it's an issue. Like, right. what if there's some dead man's switch in the firmwares out there that can shut down the
network?
Like
an
I don't know. Yeah, right. But there could be others. I don't know.
Yeah.
So it should be our responsibility to try to educate people, think about their miner, and if it's not their firmware, it's not their miner, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very good point. Make the review process as thorough as it is at the core level.
But you have to have something to review, right?
Mm-hmm. How's Brains been received by the market overall? How's reception been in your opinion?
I think the community likes it. They like the idea of really having something as a reference and standard implementation and something that's being taken care of. So, yeah, I mean, it's a new project, so we'll see what happens in the future. But we really try to maintain it, and on the long run, we want to add more, obviously, of more mining devices.
And one of the features we would definitely bring to the firmware is the protocol implementation.
Right.
It's a great thing that we can implement it on both sides, either on pool or in the firmware as well, so that we can show it works.
Mm.
And yeah, it could help with the adoption a bit.
Yeah, that's so it seems like things are progressing pretty well for you guys. What do we see going forward? What do you like you said, the progression of miners, we've gone from CPU to GPU to FPGA. We're
not ASICs.
Is there anything above ASICs, you think, eventually?
No, just smaller ASICs. So I think the current challenge is the EUV technology, the extra ultraviolet.
What's
technology.
This?
How the chips are being manufactured, right? You have a mask, and you have your wafers, and you use some ultra short length light, but it is not light at these levels, that you use for enlightening the mask, right? And that creates the footprint of the chip.
Are they photons at that point or something?
Yeah, maybe. Well, they are photons. Mm-hmm. And the problem of the current technology, once you start making the chip smaller and smaller and smaller, the wavelength really starts mattering. And this is the basic problem with the 7 nanometers, with the current sources of the, I don't want to call it light, but the thing. That makes it very difficult to create the chips. And with the EUV, the length of the light is very small. I think it's like 17 nanometers, which is already comparable with what you're trying to create as the structural sizes on the chips. But the problem is that this technology is not mature yet. So the old 7 nanometers were not using the 17 nanometers light, but it was using something like 70, whatever, which is like two orders bigger than what you're trying to create on the chip. And that makes it bad yield, big variances in the production quality, and so on. So this would be like the next step in the ASICs when this EUV matures and is like widely used and becomes cheaper. And then obviously somebody started talking about 5 nanometers and even like 3, but I mean, this is crazy. You're just on an atom level.
So we should be following the EUV progression once that gets cheaper and more fleshed out?
Yeah, and then maybe 3D structures on the chips, which already do exist, but sort of like
it's
3D.
Again,
and
super costly.
Yeah.
And there are no, quantum computers. Quantum computers are not going to break Bitcoin mining. It's interesting because a lot of people think lately that quantum computers can do crazy stuff, and they can, but they're completely useless for Bitcoin mining.
Yeah.
I had an access to a quantum computer a few years ago through some university, doesn't matter.
What was that like?
It was really interesting. I didn't know if it can be used for Bitcoin mining, so we really tried, and it was immediately obvious that it's not gonna happen. So we are going to go with the ASIC direction, and it's a great thing. Once everybody is on the physical limits, it can help you with the commoditization.
Yeah. So what does the Bitcoin mining landscape look like when we get to that point? What, in your opinion?
I think it's gonna be pretty similar. Mm-hmm. And it's a good thing. I don't think there needs to be some drama in Bitcoin mining. It's a core thing what needs to be done properly for the network to function, but no big news is necessary, I think.
Yeah.
Like for the Bitcoin itself. Obviously, there is a lot of interesting stuff you can do in the Bitcoin mining sub-industry. But for normal users, I would not guess any big news if there is enough manufacturers of similar chips.
You think it would make it more accessible, more decentralized at the end of the day? Because anybody can
buy it? Sure. Yeah. Once there is enough manufacturers producing similar chips, it's easier to compete. And yeah.
Well,
once it's boring, it's great.
Well, one thing that's limiting is the resources or the natural resources that you have. You can produce only a limited amount of silicon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have different parties interested in this silicon that's being used for the wafers in order to produce chips. We have cell phones, we have laptops, computers, everything. And the amount of these gadgets is growing, right? And within this industry, you still have to fit in with the mining part. So the limiting factor would be all these resources. And one day I saw
there the foundry comes in.
Yeah. Once we have a Bitcoin foundry, maybe
we're gonna start
but still it's gonna be a shared resource, so you would have the same like issues, right? But I mean once I saw a chart of chip technology versus the amount of companies that are able to manufacture on this technology. And it's like exponentially going down. Like initially there were like 100 companies that were able to produce chips, but they were like at 100 nanometers or whatever. I mean, I don't know the exact scales, but it eventually goes down to like 3 or 4 foundries globally that can work with the cutting edge technology, including Intel. So I mean, even if you have like different chip manufacturers, they still have to go to the foundry that has to source the wafers and that produces the chips. So, and if everybody is interested in the cutting edge technology, and obviously mining is interested in that because of the efficiency, then we have to race for the resources.
Yeah, you're gonna drive rent prices up on those foundry floors. No, it's fascinating. You're not only competing with other miners, you're competing with other people building hardware at the end of the day.
And then it comes to the physical components as well. I'm talking about that as well.
Yeah, these are the big names. Like Bitcoin mining already uses the same process and foundries as AMD or NVIDIA or companies like that. It's crazy in a sense because you're still a really small industry. It's interesting.
It proves that there's something worthwhile there, though, right?
Yeah, a lot of money.
The incentives are aligned. Some people say it's a problem of wasting energy, but when you look at what's going on with the exchange rate versus the amount of hashing power connected to the network, it directly reflects the exchange rate. And miners already do search for places on the earth with the cheapest energy. So the economical model of the whole ecosystem is not that simple.
No, I mean, this is something I've been pontificating about on this podcast. I think we should be incentivizing Bitcoin mining as much as possible to become as energy efficient as possible. Like Steve Barber, what he's doing up in Alberta, basically going to natural gas fields, which are flaring methane into the atmosphere, capping that, mining that. Like we should be trying to do that everywhere possible.
Yeah. This is a great example.
Yeah. It's, but again, we gotta go through the education. Like Bitcoin's boiling the oceans. Did you hear? We're using the same amount of energy as a small country.
Do we have to comment it?
I guess before we wrap up here, I have an interesting question for you guys. What's the most stressful, like, week or couple days or experience that you guys have had while working at Slush Pool? Like, having to be on 24/7. What's, like, the craziest emergency call
that you guys have? The first 2 days, it was 48 hours being up and, like, transferring the pool server that was, like, compromised and everything into different data centers. So we were like, I mean, like, the first day when we got involved, it was at the time when something, like, went really bad. So we were, like, up for 48 hours and working on the thing to make it run again. Because, I mean, you cannot shut it down. The hash rate is gone. How are you going to convince the miners to connect again? I mean, somehow you could, but... So for me, it was the first 2 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, like, any other incident after that, it... I mean, we do remember incidents that would last for like a day or half a day, but I don't remember like 48 hours anymore.
That was
so the first 2 days were the worst.
It was exciting.
Way to get it over with early.
We made an agreement about the whole pool and stuff like that, and then this incident came, the big hack of compromise of the single server of the pool at the time, and it was just okay. Now, and we jumped in, and yeah, it's the history from the time.
So every single day is actually better than the first one.
That's a good way. I think I would rather have like the worst day of my job ever be the first day of the job. You get it over with, and then
it's all
rosy from there. One thing we didn't get to, maybe we could touch on here to end too, is like Coinbase messages. Like what's going on there? Like the unknown blocks with nobody sharing messages, and the Coinbase starting to rise, like as like during the fork wars, the SegWit 2x, people were using the Coinbase to sort of signal that they're willing to go for SegWit 2x or user activated soft fork as a pool, putting stuff in the Coinbase. Why are you guys doing this? Are you ever throwing people off your scent by putting somebody else's name in the Coinbase, or do you do this to signal to your clients or your users, like, hey, we have this and could prove it with the Coinbase?
You're basically allowing websites or other parties to understand who mined which block.
Mm-hmm.
You can obviously say it from different sources. You can monitor what jobs the pool provides, but the easiest way for everybody is to just read information from Coinbase. But we learn, as the users or the community, we all learned a lesson from the drama about signaling SegWit. So I don't think there will be any similar situation in the future. We try to let our miners to choose what they want to signal. But in general, I think it's not a miner's job to decide the direction. There is obviously a good thing about signaling that the mining industry is ready for a change, but most of the hash rate is like already company based, or there are professional teams running the operations. So if there is a change in the protocol, they will do it properly.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be some communication, but if the whole community decides about some future change, I don't think miners would have a technical problem with it. And whether they should have a vote or not, it's a difficult or a different question, but I don't think community should be taken as a hostage for miners.
It's an interesting part of Bitcoin, like being able to signal and put a message into the Coinbase, like as you mine a block. Like
signaling is one thing, but being able to messaging or what's the name, if you can prevent some change from happening, it's something different than voting that you want this or you want something else. I didn't study all the details on some game theory level.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we would like to be in the same situation as with SegWit 2x.
Back in the day when there was the SegWit wars going on with the signaling, even though people were signaling and we had the BIP91 already deployed, I mean the patch, We were not sure to the very last day that this signaling was not false. So yeah. Even though you have signaling, you just
don't know.
I mean, you cannot say that this is going to happen.
Was it F2 pool fucking with everybody, like signaling for one way and then the other, like every few blocks?
Running so many scenarios, what can happen?
So like signaling is just there is some probability that they're really running the software that would, you know, keep the rules and follow the signaling once it become active, but
yeah, you're not. Miners are in no way sort of held to what they signal at all. They could signal do something completely.
There's no cryptocurrency. There's no cryptographic force making them switch the feature on. So
that's fascinating. It's been a fascinating hour and a half. I'm pumped you guys came through here. I want to let you get on with your blockchain week, though. Explore New York, explore Brooklyn. I guess before we leave, do you have like a parting note, a parting message for the freaks out there? The thoughts on where Bitcoin is right now, where it's going, optimistic, pessimistic? It's your time to take the floor.
I'm really optimistic. Like I can see so much effort put into the right direction and so many people doing right stuff with Bitcoin and promoting it and trying to push it the right way. So I'm really, really optimistic.
My message is, if you didn't get into Bitcoin, just get some Bitcoin before you retire. So this is the right time.
We're always stacking sats here at Tales from the Crypt. It's a good way to end it. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having us here.
Thanks for coming by. Peace and love, freaks.
Because